www.uprising.org. This is Uprising for Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. Albert Einstein once said, "All of us who are concerned for peace and triumph of reason and justice must be keenly aware how small an influence reason and honest goodwill exerts upon events in the political field." That's Albert Einstein. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Our interim assistant producer is Martina Steiner. Our intern is Laurel.
My name is David Cedeno, and I am a listener member who has been listening to the Mighty 90 for less than a year. Diversity in the programming is one of the main reasons that my dial has been locked on KPFT. I am running for the local station board to be part of something that I find to be necessary in our society, that is community. A listener-sponsored radio station is one of the answers to our ever-growing problem of a fast-changing world. Being part of the local station board will give me the opportunity to further support KPFT's diverse and positive community. Please vote for David Cedeno.
This candidate statement is property of the author only and not KPFT or Pacifica. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston.
Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Last week on the show, I announced that Arab Voices raised 90% of its goal during the Summer Sizzle membership drive. Well, I'm happy to revise that number and let you know that Arab Voices actually raised nearly 120% of that goal, because several people were calling in that we didn't tally them at that time. So that speaks volume of the support that we continue to get here at Arab Voices. And I want to thank you again so much for that. We greatly appreciate it. Shukran jazilan. Today on Arab Voices, the guest will be Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. He is an award-winning historian and author of several publications. We will talk with Dr. Maqdisi about his new book, Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations from 1820 to 2001, in which he presents a provocative and dramatic portrait of America's interaction with the Arab world and defining choice that squandered years of carefully built good relations. In this book, Professor Maqdisi explores why Arabs once had a favorable view of America and why they no longer do. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's start with Arab Voices community calendar. And there are several of them today that have to do with Ramadan. The Interfaith Women's Iftar Planning Committee, Bridget's Place, and Christ Church Cathedral are organizing a special Interfaith Women's Ramadan Iftar. Muslim women of diverse backgrounds will head tables and discuss their unique life experiences with their guests. This Ramadan Iftar or dinner will be held tomorrow, August 26th at 7 p.m. at the Great Hall of Christ Church Cathedral, located on 1117 Texas Avenue. For more information, contact Kifah at 713-231-3874. The World Affairs Council of Houston is holding a lecture titled America's Interests in a Changing Middle East. This lecture focuses on what are America's interests and responsibilities in the shifting sands of the new Middle East. This is a two-part program that examines current U.S. relationships with vital interests with views from two Middle East experts. The first part actually was held yesterday, and our guest this evening, Dr. Osama Maqdisi, was the guest speaker. And the second part is scheduled for tomorrow, and the guest speaker will be Hayim Malka. For more information, you can visit the World Affairs Council's website at www.wachouston.org. The Islamic Circle of North America, ICNA, will hold a special Ramadan Iftar dinner on Friday, August 27th at 6:30 p.m. at Shahnai Restaurant. For more information, call 713-261-4512. The Islamic Education Center in Houston will hold a special seminar titled Know Your Rights. John Floyd, a well-known criminal defense attorney and human rights supporter, along with representative from the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Houston, will be speaking on your rights and do's and don'ts if approached by the FBI or other law enforcement agencies. There will be interactive question and answer session during that seminar. The seminar will be held on Saturday, August 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the IEC Houston, located on 2313 South Voss Road. And this year's mayor's annual Ramadan Iftar and dinner is scheduled for Sunday, August 29th. And it will be held at 6:30 p.m. at the George R. Brown Convention Center. This event is sponsored by numerous organizations in the greater Houston area. The bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce will hold a special workshop titled Opportunities in Algeria. This workshop will be an exclusive briefing on the economic and business climate of Algeria with CECA Supply and Services Vice President Rami Touma. This workshop will be held on Tuesday, August 31st at 9 a.m. at the bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce located on 2323 South Shepherd Suite 1150. For more info, visit www.bilateralchamber.org. The Network of Arab American Professionals, NAAP Houston, a nonpartisan volunteer-based organization dedicated to strengthening the Arab American community, will hold a special Ramadan Iftar dinner on September 1st. For more info, visit naaponline.org. The Worldwide Movement for Justice and Peace is organizing the annual Solidarity Day of Quds, that's Jerusalem in Arabic, to be held this year on Friday, September 3rd. The Day of Quds is the day of the oppressed. People of conscience worldwide gather to express solidarity with the oppressed and exploited of the world in general, and Palestine in particular, and voice opposition to the unjust, illegal, and inhumane occupation of the Holy Land by the Zionist entity. Again, this event will be held on Friday, September 3rd from 3 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the corner of Westheimer and Post Oak in the Galleria area. For more info, visit www.alqudsday.org, and that's alqudsday.org. And the Syrian American Club is organizing a special Eid al-Fitr party to be held on September 12th at Cafe Layal in Midtown. For more info, visit SyrianAmericanClub.com. There are two more events. I'll just mention the titles briefly. They are scheduled in October, but they are very important. One of them is for Malik Jandali's musical project that's called Echoes from a Great, that will be presented in Houston, which is based on the oldest music notation in the world, discovered in Ugarit, Syria, dating back to 3400 BC. Jandali is a Syrian-American composer and pianist. The main goal of this Echoes from Ugarit is to present the rich culture of the heritage of Syria and the Levant region in an attempt to fill the gap between cultures in an effort to promote understanding, harmony, and peace. This is scheduled for Saturday, October 9th. At Rice University. And the last announcement is about the special lecture coming to Houston, also in October, for the famous Syrian poet Adonis. He will be speaking on the need for an Arab revival. This event will be in both English and Arabic. Adonis, for those who don't know him, he was nominated 3 times for the Nobel Prize and has been called today's most daring and provocative Arab poet. More information on that is at mfah.org, because that's where the event will take place, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, scheduled for October 17th. And what you just heard are just a few of many other events scheduled in Houston. For a detailed and full list of all of those events, visit our website at www.arabvoices.net. You will also find links to alternative news and resources about the Arab world, its history and civilization, as well as resources for Arab Americans and about Arab Americans. That's arabvoices.net. We will take a break now, and when we come back, we will talk with Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation and chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. We will talk with him about his new book, Faith Misplaced: The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations, in which he presents a provocative and dramatic portrait of America's interaction with the Arab world, going back to the 1819, and defining choice that squandered years of carefully built good relations. In this book, Dr. Maqdisi explores why Arabs once had a favorable view of America and why they no longer do. Of course, and as always, we will be taking your questions live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live in the studio is Dr. Osama Maqdisi. Dr. Maqdisi is a professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. He is an award-winning historian and author of several publications. In April 2009, the Carnegie Corporation named Professor Maqdisi a 2009 Carnegie Scholar as part of its effort to promote original scholarship regarding Muslim societies and communities both in the U.S. and abroad. His new book, published this year, 2010, by Public Affairs, is titled Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations from 1820 through 2001. His previous book, Artillery of Heaven, won several awards, including the 2009 John Hope Franklin Prize. He also authored The Culture of Sectarianism, Community History, and Violence in the 19th Century Ottoman Lebanon. Dr. Maqdisi has published widely on Ottoman and Arab history, as well as on U.S.-Arab relations and U.S. missionary work in the Middle East. He holds a Ph.D. in history from Princeton University. Dr. Maqdisi, welcome back to Arab Voices.
Thank you, Saeed. It's great to be here.
Thanks. We are very pleased to have you back on the show. And I'd like to set the stage for our listeners before we start diving into the recent book that you published, Faith Misplaced. You were born in the United States.
Yes.
You were raised in the Arab world, Christian, in Lebanon. So you basically have seen the Arab world from American eyes, and you've seen America from Arab eyes, correct?
More or less, yeah, that's pretty
and
much.
And that gives a lot of solid grounds to stand up and to write that book and to talk about Faith Misplaced, the broken promise of U.S.-Arab relations going back to the 19th century. You start with the year 1819 and so on. I would like to start by taking us back to that time. You begin by talking about the missionary work, and you even talk about specific individuals who took it upon themselves. They went to the Arab world. Of course, there were no countries at that time. There was no Lebanon, there was no Palestine, and so on, and mainly during the Ottoman Empire, and what their goal was. So if you can take us back and tell us about this, that's unknown to a lot of people out there.
Yes, of course I can do that. And I think you're completely correct in the sense that most Americans and most Arabs, in fact, are not aware of this extraordinary, rich, in a sense, beautiful history that goes back to the early 19th century. And so the story really begins when American missionaries, Protestant missionaries, decided in the early part of the 19th century that they would try to convert all peoples of the world into a Protestant evangelical culture and religion. And so they went off to Palestine, they went to the Ottoman Empire, they went to Hawaii, or what would become Hawaii, they went to India, they went all across the world, really, in this effort to convert people. And part of that effort was, as you mentioned, was this effort to convert the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews of the Ottoman Empire into Protestant Christianity.
So they were not targeting only, let's say, Muslims and convert them to Christianity. They wanted to convert everybody, to even Christians in the Arab world at that time, in the Ottoman Empire either, to the Protestant evangelical type of Christianity.
Absolutely correct. They targeted everybody, because the entire world, not just the Ottomans.
Was that organized, like the government behind it from the U.S. or certain churches, or was it really an individual work by missionaries that's what they wanted to do for the whole world?
It was organized by private, non-government organizations, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, the ABCFM, which would grow to become the largest foreign missionary organization of the United States in the 19th century. But it was not the U.S. government. The U.S. government had no input into this early missionary movement.
How did it all start? You talk specifically about a couple of missionaries who decided to go there, two young people you describe, and you talk about them in your book, Fisk and Parsons, going back to 1819.
Yeah, and Fisk and Parsons, Pliny Fisk and Levi Parsons, two young idealistic American Protestant missionaries who really believed that they would be able to go to a part of the world whose languages they did not know. They didn't speak Arabic, they didn't speak Armenian, they didn't speak Turkish, they didn't speak Kurdish, they didn't speak any of the local languages. But they really believed that they would be able to convince people that Protestant evangelical Christianity was the only form of true faith. And so they, in a sense, had a faith misplaced. Their faith was that they would actually be able to convert people. And the reality, of course, was very different. They arrived in the Ottoman Empire. They realized very quickly that there were all sorts of religious groups they had never even seriously considered. And they came to a realization within 5-6 years. Parsons dies fairly quickly. Fisk and then the other missionaries who arrived with Fisk and after Fisk realized very quickly that there was no future in simply telling people they're wrong and there's only one way to believe. And so the missionary movement slowly began to shift into education and eventually towards higher education. And that really is part of the first half of this book, this amazing transformation on the part of the American missionaries in adapting to a foreign reality.
Before we get, and I notice you talk a lot about the higher education system in the Middle East and how it was affected and by those evangelicals who went there and missionaries and especially the AUB, and you talked about that a lot in the book. But before that, as these were trying to convince Muslims and Jews and Christians of the Ottoman Empire in the Arab world to convert to the Protestant Christianity, how were they perceived by the Arab world at that time?
They were perceived, those who actually worked with the missionaries, the tiny group of basically Eastern Christians who were influenced by the missionaries, obviously looked at them for the most part with favor, positively, because they changed their lives. Other communities, especially the Eastern Christian churches, the Maronite Church, the Armenian Church, the Orthodox Church, all the various churches of the East, the Syrian Orthodox Church, all had a very hostile view to the missionaries because the missionaries were targeting their flocks, and so they were very hostile to the missionaries because the missionaries were also hostile towards them. So it was a very sort of fruitless encounter between Eastern Christians and missionaries at the level of conversion. It didn't go very far.
How about their views? Did they report back, or their stories heard from them, from Fisk and Parsons, about what they encountered in the Middle East and or how they were treated, or did they write about their failure at that time?
Oh yeah, I mean, one of the most spectacular things about the missionary movement is the fact that these American missionaries, these young men and the women, they're also women who arrived in great numbers towards the end of the 19th century, the middle to the end of the 19th century, they recorded diaries, they kept diaries. This was part of their training, this was part of their culture, their missionary culture. They have tremendous records. We have a huge archive of missionary writings. And also, in the Ottoman Empire, we have a lot of Arabic writing on the part of converts, on the part of Eastern Christians, and eventually in the second half of the 19th century on the part of Muslim intellectual figures, reformists in particular, who also engaged with the missionaries.
No, I'm tempted to, and I probably will wait. I will ask you that at the end, but it's about the missionaries that we see now and what some reports in Afghanistan and Iraq while the U.S. occupies these countries and so on. But I want to continue with the book and the stories that you are telling there based on facts. With the slowness of that movement, and as they realize that their faith is misplaced and they are unable to do their original goal, you said, and you write it in the book, they got into the educational system, introducing universities to the Arab world, building universities such the American University of Beirut, which had a different name at that time. So I'll let you tell us, how did that transition and how they decided to get into that?
It was a difficult transition, because in the end, it's not that they believe their faith was wrong. They just realized that their faith in converting people quickly was not going to go very far. And so they adapted, they changed. And I explore in the book, as you know, in the first half of the book, I explore how this process of adaptation was a difficult one. There was a lot of conflict, a lot of cultural misunderstanding, both on the part of the American missionaries, but also on the part of the Arabs who didn't really understand what America was and where these people really were coming from. And as a result of this adaptation, this difficult process of change, eventually some American missionaries, Daniel Bliss in particular, but others as well, ended up founding some of the most important institutions of higher education in the Ottoman Empire.
You also talk about Van Dyck in the 19th century, an American missionary who you said that learned Arabic and learned the culture there. And did that change any of their...
Well, Van Dyck was an enormous figure and a very important figure.
Yes.
Because he was one of the few American missionaries who actually mastered Arabic. And he also dressed in Arabic, or at least in local costumes. He engaged socially with Arabs, and he, as a result, became an incredibly popular and an important a mediating figure between American culture and Arab culture. And he was held in high regard by students of his. He was a professor of medicine. He was engaged in scientific research. He was a translator of the Bible. So he was a tremendous figure.
Now, was his original goal to convert also, or was it purely on the educational side?
No, his goal was to convert. Almost all these people in the 19th century still believed in conversion. The methods changed. But also there was a realization that, you know, what does conversion actually mean? So someone like Van Dyck, I think, realized in the end that it's much more important to open human contact and have social contact with Arabs, as opposed to simply telling them they're wrong. And he believed in equality in a manner that many of his fellow American missionaries at the time really had a more difficult time with.
Very well. And how did that progress? How, with the building of the education system in the Middle East, and I'm not sure if I'm really labeling it correct when I say they've built the education system there, or mainly introducing universities or higher education, or just build specific universities at specific locations, because also going back to the history, the Arabs have built universities on their own in Morocco and in Iraq and other areas of the Arab world way back, right?
Of course. I mean, it's not that they built an educational system as such, as you say.
Yes.
And as I think most people who travel in the Arab world can see today, there are, of course, very important historic institutions of higher education. Al-Azhar, of course, where President Obama gave his Cairo speech, has been around for centuries.
Yes.
Long before Harvard, long before Cambridge, long before Oxford, you had Al-Azhar. So it's not that education is new, far from it, but what the Americans brought in the 19th century was a specific form of modern education that actually appealed widely to people in the Ottoman Empire, and they were not the only ones. There were Ottoman universities, there were Jesuit universities, there were many other competing universities.
So that era, 19th century, late 1800s to early 1900s, was, and according to your book, a positive relations between the Arab world and America?
Compared to what happens afterwards. Definitely. It's all relative.
Exactly.
It was positive in retrospect, enormously positive.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, so what happened at a time, and you clearly point to Israel in the book, and that's how things started to change. Of course, we know the British mandate of Palestine, the British occupation of so many Arab countries, the French presence and occupation, mainly the French and British, throughout that Arab world, which was still the Ottoman Empire at that time, and then they, at the end, decided to divide it and so on. The U.S. at that time had hands off pretty much and just watching. Was there any intervention by the U.S. or any input by the U.S. to the British and French colonialism of the Arab world at that time?
Well, indirectly and directly. Indirectly insofar as when President Wilson during the First World War, enunciated his famous idea of self-determination.
That's part of his 14-point speech that he made, right?
Yeah, the actual claim of self-determination itself is not Wilson's, but the meaning of the idea of self-determination was something that Wilson proposed, and American radio and broadcasts spread and disseminated across the world. And so nationalists throughout the world, whether in the Arab world, whether in India, whether in China, whether in Korea, were completely captivated by this idea of Wilsonian self-determination, this idea that people had a right to determine their own future. Now, President Wilson never actually meant that people in the Third World, what we today call the Third World or in the colonial world, actually had a right to determine their own future independently. But people in India, in Korea, in the Arab world understood his phrase to mean precisely that, that they had a right, a God-given right to independence. And so they demanded that. And that caused the British and the French, who, as you said, had colonial designs on the Arab world, all sorts of problems. And so what happens after World War I is that the British and the French don't come in and say, we're colonizing the Arab world. What they say is, we're coming here to help the Arabs through the so-called mandates. So Syria is created as a mandate, Lebanon is created as a mandate, Iraq is created as a mandate, Jordan eventually is created as a mandate, and Palestine is created as a mandate. And all these, except for Palestine, they were all specifically designated to supposedly lead the native peoples towards self-determination.
Let's talk about Palestine, because you talk about that a lot in your book, as it's the main focal point in the reversal of the U.S.-Arab relations, and I think everybody can attest to that now. But going back to the early 1900s, we all know about the World Zionist Congress, where they decided they want to send all Jews to Palestine and have Palestine as the homeland for the Jews. The famous Balfour Declaration in 1917, and then the U.S. endorsed that Balfour, or initially they did not favor the Balfour Declaration, correct, at that time?
The U.S. Congress eventually endorses the
Balfour Declaration. But initially, the president at that time did not endorse it, did not publicly favor the Balfour Declaration.
He did not publicly endorse the Balfour Declaration because the President Wilson was concerned about the American missionary presence in the Ottoman Empire, and he wanted to not jeopardize that presence. But President Wilson was also sympathetic to Zionism, as far as the records show. And what happened is that he basically took a more ambivalent, ambiguous position on the Balfour Declaration explicitly, but he was in support and in favor of the idea of Zionism.
And then in 1922, the U.S. Congress officially endorsed the Balfour Declaration.
Yes, it did. And despite the fact that there were some Palestinians who tried to, or Arabs who tried to testify and tried to explain to American congressmen that Palestine was not this empty land, that there were people there, and that there are consequences to Zionism and to the Balfour Declaration.
You actually refer in your book, and I read that section, to a Palestinian surgeon, Fuad Shatara, and a Palestinian law student, Salim Tuta, at that time, that went in front of the Congressional Committee, and they talked about that and their opposition and why this is not good, and this is Palestine, and so on. I want to read a quote from your book regarding this, if I may, for our listeners here. And you say in the book, this is regarding the Balfour Declaration and so on, the lopsided debate within the U.S. Congress of 1922 illustrated a general rule on the question of Palestine. No matter how positive, sympathetic, understanding, or romantic its perception of the Jewish people, a favorable view of Zionism relied on a denial of the meaningful Arab presence in Palestine. The less one thought of Arabs, the more one could enthusiastically embrace Zionism. What was behind this, and what was behind this favoritism all of a sudden to the Zionism in the U.S.?
I think there was you're talking about 1922.
Yes.
And I think this rule still applies until today. The idea is that the more sympathetic you are to Zionism, or one's sympathy for Zionism, depends a lot on denying the fact that Palestinians or Arabs or people, regardless of what you call them, But Arabic-speaking people lived in Palestine and had a meaningful historical existence, a human existence that has to be taken into consideration. And so I think what happened in the U.S. case is that many congressmen at the time, according to the records, had all sorts of romantic biblical ideas about the restoration or about reconstituting a Christian or a Judeo-Christian Holy Land. And they were completely oblivious to the fact that there were Muslims, as well as Christian Arabs, Christian Palestinians, in Palestine. They simply had no capacity to even begin to acknowledge the historical, profound political, historical attachment to this land on the part of Arabs.
And they were not successful, obviously, at that time to convince the United States that you cannot just send all the Jews to Palestine, because this land is the indigenous Palestinian people are the overwhelming majority.
In 1917, yes, of course.
And then drastically things change, and we've got the 1947 UN partition plan of historic Palestine, where it gave Jews, who were the minority, the majority of the land, and gave the Arabs, the Palestinians there, who were the majority, part of that land. And of course that was rejected by the Arab world. And then we have the 1948 war, and then Israel declared its independence and became a state, and of course the U.S. government endorsed that immediately. And things started going down spiral big time, and as you mentioned in your book, from that time to this day, almost on a daily basis.
Yes, I mean, the Arabs had a lot of faith in Wilson and Wilsonian self-determination. They were essentially betrayed by the West in terms of what happened in Palestine. The British, of course, played the primary negative role in creating the mandate, in essentially legitimating Zionism, in allowing Zionists to establish themselves in Palestine, to organize, and eventually to take over Palestine, which is what happened, of course. And when the U.S. endorsed Israel, recognized Israel so quickly, and when the U.S. voted for partition, which, as you say, was from an Arab perspective completely unfair, because the majority population was suddenly rendered into a minority in its own land, and those who were put in the Jewish state had no political rights to their, they had to basically leave. And as a result of the war that took place in 1948, they were ethnically cleansed.
And also in 1948, the United Nations Resolution 194 that gave the Palestinians the right to return. Because during the war, 1948, Israel basically expelled over, and I've read some official estimates, 800 to 850,000 Palestinians from their villages and towns and cities. And they completely wiped out 513 villages, and that's how Israel established itself. UN Resolution 194 calls for the Palestinian refugees to return. They have the right to return. The U.S. okayed that. They did not veto that resolution, but they never acted on it, and they never, seems like, believed in it, because they are against any kind of right to return for the Palestinians.
Well, I think it's a little bit more complicated, in the sense that I think that the U.S. move in 1947 and 48 to embrace Zionism and to recognize Zionism, particularly President Truman's decision, was not based on a hatred of Arabs. It's not that President Truman didn't like Arabs or didn't or had an active antipathy to Arabs. I think what it was that there were pressing concerns for him. There was the issue of Jewish refugees in Europe. There was the romantic idea of establishing a Jewish state, a romantic Protestant idea, American Protestant or Western or Anglo-American idea of establishing a Jewish state. There was the fact that there was a very powerful, well-organized Zionist movement in Palestine itself, and of course there was a constituency, American Zionists here in the United States, who were actively lobbying for that, and there was no Arab presence, no effective Arab presence in the United States at the time, no counter-lobby, so to speak, at the time that offered any kind of effectual resistance to this idea. And so for Truman, basically, the decision was fairly obvious. There's one power that actually has a lot to give, and then you had the Arabs, who were weak militarily, despite the fact that they had independent states, that is to say Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, but these were all very weak states, and they offered no resistance. And so Truman felt And the U.S. policy has been ever since that they can both recognize Israel and, they hope, maintain Arab goodwill. And that's been the basic American contradiction ever since.
You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Our guest this evening is Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. He is an award-winning historian and author of several publications. We are talking with him this evening about his latest and most recent publication, the new book, Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations, 1820 to 2001. We'll be taking your calls live, so please call us at 713-526-5738 if you have any questions for Dr. Maqdisi. The number again is 713-526-KPFT. And then we go into the 1967 war in Israel. Before that, it had occupied about 78% of Palestine. In 1967, it swallowed the remaining 22, and that's the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which are still occupied to this date. And of course, at that time also, it occupied the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula, and it occupied the Lebanese Sheba Farms and the Golan Heights, of course, the Syrian Golan Heights, and continues to hold on all those territories till this date. The famous Six-Day War. What happened with the U.S.-Arab relations at that time and during the war and the effects after that?
Well, I think to really understand this, to understand the evolution of U.S. policy towards the Arab world, I think we have to go back to this 1948 decision. So the idea is that the Arabs say in 1947 and 48 that Palestine is an existential issue. It's a matter of life and death for the Arabs. All the Arab states mobilize against this incredibly unfair, unjust partition, the partition where Palestinians were rendered into a minority in their own land simply because of Western European movements and an originally European movement of Zionism itself, and of course because of the Holocaust, which had taken place of course in Germany, not in the Arab world. And so the Arabs felt very bitter about this, very embittered by this partition, but then they lost the war. And so as far as the Americans were concerned after the war, well, you lost the war, therefore you should accept the consequences of losing the war. Israel, the Americans felt, was a reality. At the same time, they tried to put pressure on Israel to take back some refugees. They tried to settle the rest of the Palestinian refugees in various Arab countries. And then when Nasser came to power in Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser came to power in Egypt, the Eisenhower administration took him somewhat seriously. I mean, they felt this was a real force. Nationalism, Arab nationalism, was a serious force that had to be dealt with, had to be contained. It ultimately, they felt, had to be defeated, but they took it seriously. So in 1956, the Eisenhower administration prevented, when the British and the French and the Israelis invaded Sinai and invaded Egypt, which most people are not even aware of today, that in 1956 there was this outright British, French, Israeli assault on Egypt after Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. It's Eisenhower who steps in and who forces the British and the French and the Israelis to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula. And if you recall, Eisenhower very famously goes on television to the American people, because he faced, of course, domestic pressures inside the United States to not go hard on Israel. And Eisenhower said at the time, there can be no law, he said, there can be no law if we apply one standard to our friends and another standard to our opponents. And so he said there's one law that has to be applied to everyone. And it really was a high point, I think, in U.S. diplomacy. But the problem was that after that, the nationalist movements in the Arab world, the Cold War mentality on the part of the U.S. and Israeli power and strength just made the situation get worse and worse. And in 1967, when the Arabs were defeated so quickly by the Israelis, when the Arab states, Egypt and Syria, especially Nasser, were humiliated by Israel in June of 1967, the American decision was basically, well, we can support Israel openly, militarily now after 67, and what can the Arabs do? They don't have very many options. That's been the basic U.S. policy ever since, that they can support Israel openly, and the Arabs are so weak and divided that there's really no consequence. That, I think, is the mentality that reigns.
But I think it was, wasn't it 73 when Egypt militarily was able to cross the Suez Canal and take back the occupied Sinai Peninsula from Israel?
For parts of it for a while, but that took the Americans by surprise.
And it gave some kind of a triumph temporarily for the Arab world at that time. It was a huge victory, you know, considered for that particular part at that time.
Yeah, I think it's been made into a huge victory. In the end, they lost the war. But it certainly was less of a defeat than 1967.
And you mentioned, talked about Eisenhower and the 1956 war, where he basically intervened then. Do you think, and I don't know if they are related, I just thought about that now, when Israel bombed the USS Liberty in 1967, where they killed and injured hundreds of U.S. servicemen in the sea, clearly marked USS Liberty ship, did Israel bomb that because they were fearing what the U.S. might do or might stop for the 1967 war?
Well, I think we can speculate. We don't actually know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're pretty certain it was done on purpose.
Well, yeah, that's clear.
Done deliberately.
That was clear,
the question has always been asked is why, and I don't think anyone's given a satisfactory answer.
Yeah.
In part because there's never been an investigation, a serious investigation, a credible investigation that assault. It's been covered up here in the U.S.
as
well as...
Survivors of the USS Liberty speak, and I've had several of them speak live on this show, and they talk about how they were targeted by Israel, although it knew that it was a USS, it was a U.S. Ship in the water. 713-526-5738 is the number to call and ask questions of our guest, Dr. Osama Maqdisi, 713-526-KPFT. We are talking about his new book, Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations, 1820 to 2001. Dr. Maqdisi, from 1967 to now, we have seen so many treaties between, of course, there is still a lot of era of what they've called, what the U.S. Called quote-unquote terrorism, whether it's the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, or so many other entities. And I know you talk about this a lot also in the book. But in the end, parties have talked. We've seen treaties. We've seen Oslo. We've seen Camp David. We've seen this and that. But we are back to square one. The Gaza Strip, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, the Sheba Farms. Israel continues to hold and continues to occupy the land that it did in 1967. And at the same time, it's working on systematically, ethnically cleansing Palestine, getting rid of the population, stealing more land, demolishing more houses, erecting apartheid walls. And the list goes on and on and on, continually attacking people, committing massacres. The U.S. continues to talk for peace, yet it supplies Israel with all the weapons and so on, and we know what's happening today. Why is it continuing to get worse by the minute with full, what seems to be full blind support for Israel, despite its atrocities and its war crimes that's happening to this day?
Well, that's a huge question, and the answer is we need a long time to discuss that. But the bottom line, it goes back to the issue of Arab weakness, Arab disarray, the Arab state system, the corrupt Arab state system, the dictatorships that are in the Arab world that offer no effective real resistance to Israeli oppression, and in fact these states oppress their own people. So again, for the American, I think from the United States perspective, the government perspective, it's a cost-benefit analysis. The costs, the benefits of giving Israel a carte blanche to do whatever it wants is far less expensive than actually forcing Israel to give up its conquests and forcing Israel to comply by international law and by the Geneva Conventions. And so it really comes down to Arab weakness. When the Arabs are not weak, then there will be another story.
And I'm sure we could spend hours on discussing that, but let's take some calls, and again the number is 713-526-5738. First caller is Vash. Vash, you're on there.
Hi, I have a quick question. Thank you, Professor, by the way. The discussion that you guys have, you and Saeed are having, is really, really important, and I've been getting a lot of information from it that I didn't know. I'll get to the question pretty quickly, but what it seems like from the U.S. side is, especially after 1948, there's sort of this might makes right doctrine developing. And to me, that's really, really scary, because it seems like from then on that's sort of been a foundation or a pillar of U.S. foreign policy, and that's pretty scary. I guess the question I would have would be, how did the Israeli state develop? How did they develop into such a strong military power?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, might is right is a basic doctrine of international politics and international affairs, and alas. But, of course, there are different kinds of might, and there's different kinds of power. There's military power, but there's also ideological, emotional power. There are all sorts of powers that people can deploy, particularly weaker peoples who don't have military options. And, you know, think about the apartheid, the anti-apartheid struggle, where the white racist apartheid regime of South Africa had militarily far more power than the ANC or than Mandela, but ultimately Mandela triumphed because he was able to mobilize a certain kind of power. The same goes for Gandhi, of course, in India. As far as your question regarding Israel, why were the Israelis able to develop militarily? They had enormous support from the West. They had enormous support from the French initially militarily, from various European countries, eventually tremendous support from the United States after 1967, military support. They were also united, organized, and effective. And I think one of the things I point out in the book is that many Arab critics of Israel, in other words, people who don't romanticize Zionism, who understand what Zionism has entailed, the horrors that Zionism has inflicted on the Palestinians, they don't romanticize Zionism, but they actually admired certain facets of organization. And they said, in fact, that to actually counter Zionism, you have to build a system. You can't just emotionally counter it. You have to develop systems to counter these other systems.
All right, let's take another call, and that would be from Robert. Robert, you're on there.
Hi, Saeed. I have two questions. The first one is, I mean, you've been talking about the weakness of the Arab nations throughout this the endeavor. And I'm just wondering what that means. Is it weakness? I mean, you're suggesting that it's militarily, but I suggest, and this goes back to, you know, the Balfour Declaration and the entry of the United States into the First World War, that, I mean, what I've read, it's, you know, it was these Rothschild bankers that, you know, cut a deal with the United States and Wilson to get us into World War One, and as you know, if we got into the war, then you know what they got in return was the Federal Reserve. Interesting enough that we're still dealt with that, but we're, you know, I mean, it seems like today, I mean, it's the money. I mean, it's the economy. It's the money that is making Israel strong and the Palestinians and the Arabs weak. I mean, it's quite clear that okay. Saudi Arabia's got the money, but, you know, it's a kingdom, and they're not sharing it with Palestinians, of course.
Okay. Robert, I have only 3 minutes okay. left, 4 minutes, if you have a direct question for Dr. Maqdisi.
Okay, well, this is something interesting, because I just got an email from Gilad Atman here the other day, and, well, lo and behold, he's announcing that there's going to be a one-state solution conference. And guess where it's going to be?
In Houston, I know.
Oh, you do? Okay, well, tell me about that.
Well, we can talk about it later, but we want to spend much time with our... That's just a view. Some people are organizing a conference. Their views is for one state, but a lot of people are not pro-one state either. Well, I can ask. We'll have feedback from the guest on that. Thanks, Robert,
okay.
for your call.
Right.
Okay, let's... before that, we'll continue to take more callers. Next one is Roger. Roger, you're on there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm not really well-informed on this topic. But I have a naive question and then maybe another one if there's time. So I just tuned in and I heard your guest say, you know, the U.S. decided to blindly and sort of in the face of Arab, the Arab world's sensibilities defend, Israel militarily after, as he put it, the Arabs were humiliated in 1967. My question is, didn't they attack Israel? I mean, he didn't actually say that, but the war was begun by the Arab states, so it's not as if Israel attacked them and then defeated them. They were attacked, yes?
No, you're talking about 1967? No, 1967 was an Israeli airstrike, began with Israeli airstrikes on Egypt and on the air forces of Syria and Egypt and Jordan, as Israel actually initiated that war. Of course, the Israelis claim it's self-defense, as all nations who attack other nations claim self-defense. And in 1956, of course, before 1967, the Israelis pretty much did the exact same thing when they conquered the Sinai Peninsula in this war with the British and the French. The issue really was, and has always been, the Israelis are determined to create a Jewish state despite the fact that they live in an Arab, an overwhelmingly Arab environment. And that has tremendous, there's a tremendous contradiction right there.
All right, let's take our next caller, Kathy. Kathy, if you can make your question very short, please. Go ahead, you're on there.
Yes, my question is, what do you think the options are to start resolution over all of this mess that has been going on for generations and generations?
I think that's an excellent question to end the show with, so thanks for your call, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Maqdisi, any hope?
Hope, there's a fool's hope, but I think the hope is that you continue to mobilize, and ultimately the idea of building a movement that ultimately believes in equality and justice, equal rights, it's a movement that is not going to put faith in any of the government efforts, whether we're talking about the U.S. government today or any other government efforts in the Middle East, because these are all incredibly cynical movements to basically distract people. Peace will not come from the current U.S. government in the Middle East. Peace will not come from the Arab governments, which are corrupt, and peace will not come from the Israeli government, which is colonizing the West Bank and Jerusalem.
So you say movements by the people from grassroots.
It's to put pressure. It's a long-term...
Everywhere in the Arab world and in
everywhere.
The United States and in Europe. And
Palestine is not just an Arab movement. Palestine is now a global movement.
Yes.
And because we're talking about something that all people should believe in, which is equal rights and equal dignity and basic decency, whether we're talking about Muslims, Christians, or Jews, everybody really should believe in these things, and we should fight for these things.
So you think the current negotiations and the dealings and wheelings and what they call direct negotiations, indirect, this is nothing but a waste of time, basically, at the end.
This is a cynical manipulation of words. We all know it. It's not going to lead anywhere.
And unfortunately, the tragedy continues, and people are paying dearly with their own hearts and minds and bodies throughout the Middle East with this. Well, we could have easily spent 2-3 more hours, but unfortunately our time is up. The book is titled Faith Misplaced: The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations 1820 to 2001 by Dr. Osama Maqdisi, Professor of History and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University. This book is already available in stores everywhere, bookstores and online. Dr. Maqdisi, thank you so much for your time. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Saeed, and thank you all.
Thank you, and thanks for listening to Arab Voices, and thanks to Sherry for her assistance on the board and the phones tonight. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Technology Bites is coming up next. Thanks for listening, and until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
I'm Gladys House, and I want to be on the local station board of KPFT to contribute to the creativity and expansion of programming to attract a broader listening audience and increase the fundraising of KPFT. The local station board would work to give input and have ongoing dialogue with Pacifica and KPFT staff to broaden the concepts and stay current with state-of-the-art programming and technology. KPFT can better serve the community by conducting regular public sessions to get input and concerns of the general public. I seek your support, your vote on the ballot. Please vote Gladys House. Again, cast your vote for Gladys House. Thank you very much.
This candidate statement is property of the author only and not KPFT or Pacifica.
This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 Galveston.
No matter where you are on the political spectrum, KPFT is a daily check-in on the workings of democracy.
Part of a democracy is an independent press and media. Media like this is supposed to be the check and balance on government.
And community radio is one of those few media outlets left that is still completely independent. That's why, in this age of the greatest media consolidation America has ever seen, having different voices out there is essential. KPFT has been around since 1970, and we have survived through contributions of people like you. Listeners who donate to KPFT support us because they know that's what keeps KPFT independent. Why wait for a pledge drive? You can join KPFT online at kpft.org. Help keep KPFT vibrant with your financial contribution. Visit us at kpft.org to join us securely online. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT.